Hi, I am Daniela Stockflet-Menis. Welcome to my podcast, Because Everyone Has a Story, the place to give ordinary people's stories the chance to be shared and preserved, or stories become the language of connections. Let's enjoy it, connect and relate, because everyone has a story. In this episode, you are in for another treat. I am excited to talk about my friend Jennifer Butler's new book, her authoring process, and of course the book itself. She has a passion for preserving stories like me with this podcast. This is what she accomplishes with her first book, Boom and Bust, The Resilient Women of Historic Telegraph Cove. Let's enjoy her story. First of all, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Danielle.
This is Jennifer. You wrote a book called Boom and Bust. And so we are going to talk about this book.
Well, my story is about the women who lived in a tiny isolated village on the northeast coast of Vancouver Island called Telegraph Cove. My great grandparents were the first people to own the land. They named it Telegraph Cove in 1912, when it became the terminus for the telegraph station for Vancouver Island. And they were the ones that built the businesses there. And then my grandparents lived all their adult lives there. My mom was born there. My aunt was born there. And I got to spend all my childhood and adolescent and university summers up there visiting my grandparents. When I thought of the idea, I wanted to write about what it was like for the women, because there aren't that many stories about women pioneers and what it's like for that half of the population in small, rural, male-oriented resource villages and towns.
I noticed we were told a story from the male point of view, and now I think they're showing more the history of women that in the past have actually been behind those men that were important.
Yes, I was actually in the village of Telegraph Cove in 2015. I remember it was a beautiful September day. I was actually up there representing my family at an event. Lots of people were coming up to me and they were saying, oh, your grandfather was such a character. Tell me more about him. And, oh, your great grandfather who started this place. That must have been wonderful. And I remember thinking, nobody's asking me about my grandmother or my great grandmother, who I thought were more interesting people. And that's when I thought, I could write about them, and I could write about all the women that lived in this tiny village, because my grandparents and my mum and my aunt were there right from the very beginning. So they knew all the people that were there in the 1920s and 30s. And then when the next generation after the war came, those children, the baby boomers, as it were my summertime friends. So I knew them and I knew their mums. And so between the historical records that my family have kept, I have the history of this entire little village, which despite its size, it only had maybe 45 people living at it in any one year. The population peaked at 60, and yet it was directly impacted by all the events that took place in the 20th century, certainly in Canada in the 20th century. There was the Depression, the war, there was Japanese internment, occupation, then the baby boom, post-war social change, and the big transition from the resource-based economy to tourism, where it's now booming.
Fascinating. And it is true. What about my grandmother? Everybody always tend to mention the grandparents. So that's great that you have the opportunity. So it's from 2015 until the book came out on 2019?
Yes. So it took about, I guess about a year and a half of research. Where do you start with once you have the idea? I thought, okay, I will interview my mom. She's alive. She's got a very good memory. And she also has boxes of family information, all the documents about Telegraph Cove right from the beginning when my great-grandparents bought it in 1911. And she has pictures from the teens and the 20s and 30s and 40s by the box load. And all the, as I say, all the documentation. My great-grandfather wrote his memoirs, which were more or less accurate. My grandmother had recorded herself on cassette, her memoirs in the 1970s. And one of my brothers had digitized these, so I had access to her voice telling me about her life as a young woman. So that was a great place to start with my mum and all the material that she had. My aunt as well was still alive, and so she's 5 years older than my mum, so she added her memories. And then from there, I was able to get a list of the women that they were still in contact with, writing letters at Christmas time and that sort of thing. So I would get phone numbers or emails or addresses, and I would contact these women and tell them what I was wanting to do. And they all knew me already, or they knew of me through my mum. So the doors were open to me, and I would arrange to meet with them. I would have a little recording app on my iPhone, and I would just let them talk. I try not to interrupt and just listened to the story. Didn't take notes. I thought it was far better to have that open, authentic conversation with them just at the kitchen table. They were more than generous with their experiences, their life experiences, as well as providing information and more names for me to follow up with, because maybe they had known a woman who had lived up there for only a year, but they kept in touch with her. So I got that contact, and then I could try and find more and more of the women. I figure that there were maybe 400 people that ever lived in this tiny place.
Wow.
And I extrapolated that perhaps one quarter of them were female, so 100 women.
Huh.
And I was able to find or name at least 50 of them, which was quite good, and certainly got the key stories of about 25 of them.
How innovative from your grandmother to record her history in a tape.
Yes.
In a tape.
And she was a young woman in Victoria. She watched Victoria being built. She watched the Empress Hotel being built. And she was a nurse during the First World War. And so she nursed the soldiers who were coming back from war. She was a nurse during the 1918-1919 pandemic. And then she went off to Quesnel, where she nursed in a tiny, what was a very rural farm community. There were still gold prospectors living in the hills that she would go on horseback to attend to. And then she was a smallpox specialist. She'd actually contracted smallpox, but she recovered from it. She was immune, so she was put in charge of smallpox patients in another island hospital. And then she ended up in Alert Bay, which is where she met my grandfather. And then they moved to Telegraph Cove during the Depression and started their life there. So my grandfather, who'd been born in New Westminster, moved to Alert Bay when he was 9, and that's where he grew up. So my grandmother had, I think, a much more fascinating mm-hmm. early life, let alone what she dealt with as the medical professional and the wife of the owner in this tiny village.
Yes. What a coincidence. My grandmother, from my mother's side, was also a nurse.
Oh.
She was the first one graduated at 15 as a nurse in Venezuela. And she ended up being a director of a hospital as well. So these women that you hear, that is not the norm to being going in pursuit of a career at that time, and they made it.
Many options for careers. You mm-hmm. know, you could become a nurse, you could become a teacher, maybe an office worker of some kind, a bookkeeper or something. And that was really all that women were able to do. And so a bright, ambitious woman, that was an avenue for her to move ahead. And in a place that really was, it started actually as the telegraph line shack, and then it became a fish saltery with a small box mill that made the boxes for the salted fish to get shipped to Japan, where there was a big market for salted BC Fish. And then the sawmill expanded and became a robust business for about 50 years. And it was always men that worked in the saltery and the mill. So the women going to Telegraph Cove were by and large the wives or the daughters of these men. And so most of them worked in their home. They were housewives, but they had to be teachers, and they had to sew the clothes, mend the clothes, look after the home, wash the clothes without washing machines that we know now. Mm-hmm. They were cooking on a sawdust stove, which is very temperamental, and all in isolation. There were very few that then were able to have a life amongst each other, let alone amongst other people. The only way into this place was by boat for most of its history. The steamship would come once a week on Thursdays, and that's when you could get newspapers, you could get fresh fruit and vegetables, paint and nails and clothing and fabric and anything else except lumber that came up, but it only came up once a week. And there was nothing else there. There were no shops. There were no businesses. There was one general store that was connected to the mill. You would get paid on tick, as it were, at the store. You would then put all your purchases against your pay at the end. A lot of the women had, this was their only social activity, was to get together on Thursday morning when the steamship came in. And these women and men were in their 20s and 30s. They were very young. And you think how hard it must have been for them to not have the movies and the shopping and many of the things that people living in the cities would have taken for granted.
I think that people appreciate that life. Some of them do, right?
Yes.
I got the book. It came out last year. I started to read it not long ago. And I have to say that I love the way it's written. It's really engaging. And I'm still reading it. Then I like the portions that, you know, your family first. And then I went all the way to Grace Darcy. And one of the questions that I want to ask you first is that you can explain to us the title.
Well, yes. Okay. It was kind of a working title and it was a little bit tongue in cheek. The original working title was Booms and Busts because it's a village, a sawmill village. And so it was full of log booms and it was about women.
Mm-hmm.
But the publisher, probably quite rightly, thought that maybe that was not quite the right title. And they liked shortening it to Boom and Bust, which actually kind of fit because any resource village is an economically viable and then not viable location. And during many of its decades, it was doing really well. And then there was a scramble for money and work and everybody had to tighten up. And then it would have good times again. So Boom and Bust worked out quite well. But I wanted to make sure that there was a secondary title, which is The Resilient Women of Historic Telegraph Cove, because otherwise people might think it was a book about economics.
I really enjoyed the characters and the way you put your great-grandfather. And then I can see, wow, your grandmother is strong, but she could be like maybe not like the nicest person to work with.
Oh, I think one of the men told me, yes, the mill men had a nickname for your great-grandmother, Mame, and it sure wasn't Mame. Yeah, I think she was she was limited to what she could do as a woman. My great-grandfather was a very capable, affable man. He was awful with money and he was awful judge of character. Mm-hmm. And she was very good with money and a good judge of character. So when he was off investing in gold mines that were going defunct, she would be buying up land and having houses built for rent. And this is what fueled her income. She liked buying nice clothes. She liked having nice things. And she did it with her own money.
So out of, obviously, out of your great-grandparents and your grandparents and your parents, Is there any other character that you learned from your research that caught your attention or that you thought, oh, how fascinating, something I didn't know?
Oh, yes. This was what was great. I knew a little bit about a lot of the women, and I knew the stories were really interesting. But then by actually just letting them tell their stories, I was really blown away by the amazing lives that some of these women had had almost in secret. And I did not want my book to be a family history. I knew my great-grandparents and grandparents were the reason why this little place existed, but I really wanted this to be about all the women that contributed to what life was like in Telegraph Cove. So there were, one of the stories that I found really fascinating was the Japanese women who, there was a Japanese businessman who was a partner with my great-grandfather and grandfather in developing the saltery and the box mill. And so he hired Japanese men and they brought their wives and brought up their children in Telegraph Cove. And when the Pearl Harbor was bombed in 1941, then all of a sudden there was a directive by the Canadian government to remove all Japanese Canadians, or whether they'd been born in Canada or in Japan, anyone of Japanese heritage was moved away from the coast. This then affected a huge number of people. And in Telegraph Cove, there were several Japanese families. Many of them had caught wind that this was going to happen and moved away of their own accord. But one family decided to stay and they got caught. And in March of 1942, a Canadian naval officer came to their door, knocked on it, and told them they had 3 hours to gather up their things and leave. They had to leave everything behind except what they could carry.
They had to leave to Japan?
No, they had the choice. They could go back to Japan or they could be interned in British Columbia. And the woman, Nancy Okura, she had been born in Steveston, Richmond. Mm. So she was a Canadian woman. Her family were Canadian. So she wouldn't go back to Japan. She didn't have family there. When they were taken to Vancouver, they were split apart. The husband was sent to the interior of BC on a road camp. And she, with her little baby, was kept with all the other women and young children at the P&E in Vancouver. They lived in the agricultural building and they would put up sheets between the beds. They were given mattresses made of straw, and they were left there in the winter with no heating. It was a very harsh treatment for these, many of whom had established businesses and were very affluent, very educated, and they were there for months. Nancy was the one who was able to get a family group together, which then allowed them to move into the prairies and work, live together and work on a sugar beet farm, which they did for a number of years. At the end of the war, they still could not move back to the coast. That directive was not lifted until 1949. So they moved to Ontario and brought up their children there.
So they could go anywhere else, but not to the coast?
Yes.
Why?
Well, there was a lot of jealousy among the British Columbia fishers because the Japanese fishers were very successful and they had been successful for many decades. This racism and this prejudice had been around for a long time. With the Pearl Harbor bombing and the concern about a potential Japanese invasion of the coastline, British Columbia, it was thought to be expedient to move people into the interior, but really this was buying into and answering to the prejudice that many Japanese businesses had already felt.
What a terrible thing.
And there were two women who had been children during the Second World War in Europe. So they had a very opposite experience. One of them was born in Berlin, and she was a young girl in Berlin when the war was declared. Her father was forced to fight for the German army, and her mother had to keep the family business in order on her own. When the tide turned against Germany, and the bombs were starting to land on Berlin, this young girl, Eva Vinderskov in the book, her married name, was moved to a school in Czechoslovakia, as it was. And of course, they couldn't leave the confines of the school because they were German and hated because the Germans had taken over their country. When the war ended and Germany had lost, suddenly this young woman, along with her schoolmates, had to flee and get back to Berlin. ahead of the Russian bombing raids. That was just a horrendous journey that this young girl would make. I believe she was about 12 years old at the time. Then after the war, she's a young teenager. She's a great athlete. She wants to be a travel agent. Well, no one in Europe post-war is able to travel. And whenever she did go anywhere, as soon as she opened her mouth, people could hear she was German and they didn't like her because of that. So the prejudice worked against her just as an innocent young woman. She married a Dane and they lived in Copenhagen for a couple of years. Again, every time she opened her mouth, people heard her German accent. And so they got tired of this and the limitations of a post-war life on a young person. So they moved to Canada and they ended up in Telegraph Cove. And the other woman was a young child in Northern Italy during the war. And Italy was allied with Germany at the beginning, yeah, and then later on was allied with the Allies, or switched sides to join the Allies. It was Benito Mussolini was the fascist ruler of Italy. So her life was not an easy one either. She married, again, very limited options for them in post-war Europe. And so they emigrated to Canada and ended up in Telegraph Cove.
Wow.
And this woman, they both went on to have successful businesses. Eva and her husband left Telegraph Cove and started their own business in the building construction trade and did very well for themselves. And Lisa Zigiotti, she was not able to work when she was bringing up her five children in the cove. But later on, she actually got work at the nearby dry sort, which is a sort of where lumber is processed. And she studied to become a log scaler, which is an incredibly technical position, requires a huge amount of education and study and knowledge in order to be able to assess the value a log will have on the market when it is cut for lumber. And many people take this exam, struggle to pass. And Lisa, at the age of 50, passed it first time.
Wow. Incredible. So there's three of your favorite characters.
Yes. And some of the teachers. This was a tiny village, but my grandmother was very focused on education. This was really important to her. So when my aunt was getting close to school age, my grandmother went to Victoria and went to the superintendent of education and petitioned to have a school in Telegraph Cove. And they told her, well, you have to build a school, you have to build accommodation, and then you have to guarantee 10 children, and then we will hire a teacher. And or they would hire a teacher, but the government would pay for the teacher. So my grandmother went back and got a school built. She got accommodation built, very rudimentary. And there were very rarely 10 children in Telegraph Cove, but my grandfather would fudge the numbers to make sure that there was a school teacher always hired. The teachers that Telegraph Cove received were often first-time teachers, their first year. They were inexperienced, very young women, because they couldn't afford to negotiate to go anywhere else. Telegraph Cove was very isolated. It didn't pay well. It was not what you would call a catch position. And yet Telegraph Cove got some amazing young women teachers. One of them, one you mentioned, Grace Darcy, she had been in a very difficult household situation. So she left a very difficult marriage with her three children, came to Telegraph Cove and became the teacher. In her summers, she continued her study. She then went on to get her master's degree at Stanford University. And then she became the superintendent of the public library system for schools in the province of Manitoba. And Dory Gray is another fascinating woman. Doris Gray, everybody who knew her called her Dory. She was a young woman who was almost blind. She was tiny. She had a facial tic. Someone like that could easily have been marginalized by the community. But she came to Telegraph Cove and was brilliant. She inspired a generation of children. And then she went on to get her master's and her PhD at Columbia University in New York, where she became a professor and wrote textbooks on children who have sight issues and brain traumas. She taught herself Braille and wrote textbooks in English and in Braille. Amazing woman. And these young women worked in Telegraph Cove. Yes. It's just fascinating.
So your grandfather, where did he study? Because there was no school.
Well, my grandfather was actually 9 years old when he moved to Alert Bay, which is across the strait from Telegraph Cove.
Okay.
And his father, my great-grandfather, was hired to manage the box factory for the BC Fishing and Packing Company in Alert Bay. So my great-grandfather, my great-grandmother, and my grandfather, Fred, lived in Alert Bay. And they managed the sawmill there. And they bought this village of Telegraph Cove. It wasn't a village. They bought the land, about 376 acres of land across the strait on Vancouver Island. They did some of the logging, which the logs then were towed to Alert Bay for the sawmill. And then in 1912, when the superintendent of telegraphs came up to the area looking for a terminus station that was protected from the elements, from the winds and the rains of winter, he was taken to this little place by my great-grandfather, and that's where he decided the name of Telegraph Cove would be perfect, because that's where the telegraph station would be. So the village wasn't really built until the 1920s. And there were no children there until the early 30s. My aunt was born in 1929. My mother was born in 1934. And really, they were the first children, along with a few of the Japanese children. And so it's when they became of school age, that's when a school was built. So really, the very first children that could go to school got their school right at the right time.
I see. I get it. 4 years it took you to do the writing.
It took about a year and a half of research, and then it took me another year of writing. And then it was looking for a publisher. As a first-time writer, I didn't really know how possible it would be to get my manuscript looked at, let alone published. But I had a hunch that this would be an interesting story. People are becoming more interested in local history and in women's stories. Mm-hmm. And I felt that there was a gap for something like this. If somebody felt it was written well enough, I figured it could actually get published, but with a local publisher. So I went to the library. I went to bookstores. I started to look at books that were similar to my book and see who had published them. And then I went online to see whether they would accept first author submissions. And then I sent my manuscript to three publishers. And one of them I really hoped would take it, because I thought they were the perfect fit. It's a publisher based in Victoria. It's owned by a woman. The publisher is a woman. And they do a lot of great stories about the Beastie history, really beautiful books. And that was the one that responded. And Touchwood Editions published my book.
That's wonderful, because people have issues trying to get a publisher, and you only apply for three and you got the one you wanted.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And are you planning to write a second book?
Well, I have ideas. I'm incubating ideas. This was a bit of a passion project, I have to admit. I've always wanted to write a book ever since I was little. I was an avid reader. I could read before I went to school. I loved reading, and I always wanted to write a book. But I never felt I had anything to say. Mm-hmm. I lived my life. My curiosity was fed by books and travel and different careers. And it wasn't until 2015 when I got the idea for this book and felt, yes, this is a story that I could tell. And maybe only I could tell. I realized how lucky I was that I had all the material. I knew all the people. I had all the doors open to me, and there probably isn't another person who would have been able to have that available to them to write this book. So I felt very responsible to the women in the book. I wanted it to be the right book. I had an image in my head of how I wanted it to be. The publishing process was very collaborative. Taryn Boyd, the publisher, was wonderful. There was a huge amount that went into it. The manuscript had to be cut in half, which is hard emotionally, but she was right because we wanted to get a lot of photographs in there. And I really wanted to get a few maps in there and other formatting things. And so it really was a very collaborative process. All the editors who worked on it, the designer, were terrific. And I probably stood up for a few things that first-time authors might not normally be allowed to do, but I was lucky to have someone who really listened to me and who would let me pick my battles and fight for the maps or the photos or a certain way that something was presented. My favorite part of the process was when it was all done and I got the box of books and I opened the books and I saw my name on a beautiful published book. And then I immediately got on the phone and I phoned all the women who were still alive, who lived in British Columbia. And I made a plan to deliver the book to each of them by hand. I drove probably about 1,200 kilometers in 4 days and got them to sign my copy and I signed their copy. That was sort of part one of what I wanted to do with the book. And the second part was I wanted to donate my royalties to organizations that support women's health and well-being on Vancouver Island. I found two organizations based in Campbell River. One is the Campbell River Hospital Foundation, and one is the Campbell River North Island Transition Society. And that's something that's really important to me. They provide support for women now that the women of Telegraph Cove wouldn't have had available to them. And some of them really had tough times, didn't get a lot of help except that which was available to the other people that lived in Telegraph Cove at the time. So it was really important for me that my book had a legacy beyond storytelling and help support women's health and well-being in the future.
That's very nice of you. So every time somebody buys a book from you, the money goes to these charities.
Yes, my royalties are all donated to these two charities.
Fantastic. That's very generous of you. I want to know, who is Jennifer? Because I don't think, from what you just said at the beginning, you were not a writer. You're more of an engineer.
Well, I started my career, I suppose, as a school teacher. I was a school teacher in Kelowna. I was the music specialist for the school. I taught grade 3 and 4. I was also a dancer. And then the travel bug has always been with me. Travel to me is one of those eat and drink things. My home is a good anchor base, but I always need to have the nourishment of travel. And so I left Canada. I traveled around Europe for a year. I wasn't ready to come back to Canada, so I lived in London, where I did all sorts of jobs to pay the bills, and I trained to become a sound recording engineer, which I did in London for 4 years at a studio in Soho, London. We specialized in radio and television commercials and film. I helped develop the sound effects for a movie called Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which became a hit. And I was the main engineer for Talking Books, which I think our studio was the first studio in Britain that did talking books for pleasure rather than for the blind. That was great. And then I moved on to other careers and other careers. I ended up working for myself here in Vancouver, where I was born and raised. Then my husband and I got together and formed a partnership where I became the writer and editor of our work. But that's more technical writing and writing for the academic research community. I still, all the way through all those different lives and careers and traveling, I always wanted to write my own book on a creative side rather than the technical side where you're editing someone else's work.
Exactly. And knowing that you are very technical on your writing for work, the writing was amazing because I know that you are writing in a different style, but this book was so engaging. It was just like a storytelling, perfect storytelling.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I wanted to keep it honest and authentic, and I wanted to use the women's words as much as possible. So in a way to let them tell their story and keep it simple, because the stories are really what guides you. It's, I don't want people to read the words and think of someone writing them. I want them to read the words and imagine the woman telling them.
Yes. And another thing, you are very fortunate, is how much information you have about your great grandparents. I've been telling everyone that I only know the names of my great grandparents, but you have letters, you have comments, you have what my grandmother used to say about my grandfather or my great grandfather. Is amazing.
I was lucky that the 1920s, photography was new technology, and my grandparents were young people in the 1920s. They were in their 20s themselves, so they have pictures of picnics and events and rowing boats and other boats and fish boats and parties. They had so many parties, all daytime. Interestingly enough, I had no pictures of nighttime because there was no flash photography. But there were masses of pictures, and they kept letters that they wrote to each other, and they kept all the documents because, of course, they had the businesses. And my mom remembers her grandmother, so she's able to keep her grandmother alive to me, who never met her. My great-grandmother died before I was born. Through my mom's memory, I now can picture what my great-grandmother was like. And this is why I'm so grateful that my grandmother recorded her youth on cassettes. Mm. Little did she know that 50 years later, her granddaughter would hear her voice on cassette again. And to hear that familiar voice to me, because I knew her as an adult, and to hear her tell her story in her voice was so moving to me. And I would go to some of the archives. The Alert Bay archives in the library were great. The excellent little museum in Campbell River has a great archive. And the BC archives in Victoria, connected to the Royal BC Museum, that was the best. They had wonderful documents, but they also had cassettes of interviews of people who lived up in the region. Many of the people I remembered from my childhood. And some of those interviews were of my grandfather. So again, to hear my grandfather's voice was very resonant. I do tell people, tape yourself, tape your mother, tape your aunt, tape your grandmother. If you can, record these voices talking about their memories, which when they're gone, those will be gone. And it's the little things, the little anecdotes that no one else would know, that you want to hear them describe. And I think people should record themselves and talk about their childhood and what it was like when they were getting up at Christmas morning or going for a hike or spending time with their family and their brothers and sisters in school. All these little memories that we all have that we don't think are of any importance. Who knows? Maybe in 50 years, grandchild or a great niece or a family friend is going to hear your voice and remember you. And maybe it'll go somewhere.
It's exactly why I started the podcast as well, because I recorded my grandmother. She came to visit Canada in 2012. She was 94 years old. I recorded her with a video camera, and I wanted to know how she used to live when she was younger. Because, you know, your grandmother, you don't really ask the questions that you would think about it when you are much of an adult. How wonderful it would be that my kids or my great-grandkids can hear my voice as a young woman, not remembering me only as the old grandma, old great grandma, she cannot even walk. But actually the fact that I had a story, that I was young, that I had feelings, and it is beautiful to be able to record stories, because everyone has a story, and you have lots of stories in this book.
And I've been loving hearing back from people who have read it and their children and their grandchildren, because many people just look at their mother or grandmother as this old lady. And now they're thinking, well, not only is my grandmother in a book, but they're discovering their grandmother as a young woman who had this very interesting inner or external life, maybe looking at her more as a person. This is why I applaud you for your podcast, because I have always felt the same way, that everybody has a story and we need to ask questions. We don't just assume something by look at somebody. We may know what happened in the past, but we don't know why or how. And that's the more interesting question to ask.
Exactly, exactly. I want to talk about the pictures. Somehow the photos that I see, these ladies are dressed really nice, like they are in the city. Oh, fancy. I know that it's colder, and when it's really cold, it's best to be dressed with fur. The shoes, the clothes, they don't look like the ladies who are in the middle of nowhere.
And this is a lumber town.
Exactly.
Telegraph Cove is about 15 houses situated along a boardwalk on stilts over a cove in a forest with tight, steep cliffs on either side. It's not where you would go and wear your high heels. And these women couldn't buy clothes. You couldn't buy clothes off the rack. So they would get fabric and they would make their own clothes. And they, some of them were wonderful seamstresses. They would get secondhand clothes and turn them into something completely new and make the most incredible outfits, not just for themselves, but for their children. And always were smartly dressed, wearing gloves, wearing hats, wearing fine coats. And when the steamboat came on Thursday morning to deliver whatever was being delivered that day, the men would wear suits and the women would wear their beautiful coats and hats and gloves and heeled shoes and come down on the boardwalk to greet the boat and chit chat because this was their social life. There were occasional dances on Saturday night. Later on, they would show a movie in the community hall or have coffee parties, but they were very rare. You know, life was really hard. You worked in your home pretty well the whole time, and there were no other diversions. Mm-hmm. And so to get dressed, to be able to make these clothes and then to wear them just to greet people at a boat,
yes,
this was the only time they could wear them.
Yes, I guess we are in the same situation at the moment with COVID.
Although I think we are often more casual with our clothes, and often I don't wear shoes one day to the next. And yet these women were, part of it was the era, part of it was how they were brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And also they were intent, making a statement in a way about life. And Telegraph Cove was a different logging town than other logging towns. And it was because of the women. They made sure the kids went to school. They made sure that there was no drink, there was no gambling, no fist fights like there were in other lumber camps. They hired families to keep the school operating. And the kids at Telegraph Cove all look back now and say, yeah, we did have a different life. Every other woman in Telegraph Cove was kind of like a surrogate mom. There was always somebody to watch out for them, somebody to look after them if there was a medical emergency and someone had to leave, for example. Another mother would just look after all the kids that needed some care. So there was definitely a family-oriented, civil place there where the women really helped keep the community of Telegraph Cove safe and caring as possible in the circumstances for all the children that lived in the cove.
Hmm. Grace Darcy, who was one of the teachers, I thought it was funny, and I think it's very relatable now, that she said that when she got there, the first thing she did was to open the Eaton's catalog and order 4 sleeping bags so for her family could sleep through the night in comfort. And I like this ordering online. I don't know how that happened, but I was thinking, wow, things haven't changed too much these days because we're still ordering now online more than ever. And it is the Ethan catalog. I mean, I've been in Canada for 24 years and Ethan was here. So
yes, Eaton's and Woodward's. Woodward's for food and Eaton's for everything else. And you would put in your order and then it would come up on the next steamship. So you would have to wait maybe a week or two for it to arrive, but you would put in the order through the general store and then it would come up the next week and you could get almost anything. I remember as a child, those catalogs at Christmas time, they had toys and clothes and fashion and bedding and housewares and everything. They were like a treasure trove. And I can imagine for a place that didn't have a store, this was how you shopped.
Yes, and they were, it was like two.
Oh, they were thick. They were great big, thick things. Oh, we all look forward to when the new catalogs arrived, usually in the spring, summer, and the autumn, winter. And then there was often a special one at Christmas with the toys in it.
I know. So things haven't changed much. Now we have it on the website, delivered much faster.
Yes.
But it's the same. So that, I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
So anything else?
Well, one of the things that I found interesting is since the book came out, I'm really happy. It's been a BC bestseller. It was actually Canadian number one for nonfiction for 1 week in July.
Ooh.
Many people have contacted me at events or through my website, have said that even though their mother's life in the prairies or in the mountains or on the East Coast was very different in some ways to the women who lived in Telegraph Cove on the West Coast of Vancouver Island, there were similarities in terms of what their lives were like in a rural, isolated community. And I think that was interesting for me. I hadn't expected that it would resonate with people who grew up in different locations, but experienced things like the old washing machines and the way that a cooker might be temperamental and having to wait for things to be delivered. It might be on a train or a truck or a horse-drawn wagon or a boat, but there were very similar experiences. And it made me think that the women of Telegraph Cove, their lives through the 20th century, the book went up to the era when the resource-based economy changed to tourism and recreation. I couldn't really take it up to present day. The women who are living up there are still living their histories. And it made sense to end the book in the mid-1980s. Telegraph Cove also has the distinction of having been the location of British Columbia's very first whale watching organization. So that's pretty cool as well. The little place of about 45 people seems to hit well above its weight in terms of its impact on the world. I would say that probably living through the year, there might be six or so.
Six people living there now?
Yeah, not many. But in the summer, in an average summer, when international travel is possible, it gets about 100,000 people every summer.
Sleeping there or just passing by?
Both. You can rent out the old houses, have been taken over by a current family. And so all the old houses where the people lived for the last 100 years, you can rent them out and stay in them. There are new accommodations. There's a campground. There's an RV park. You can go for the day. You can go kayaking or hiking or fishing. There's whale watching. There's an excellent whale interpretive center there. You can go grizzly bear watching. It's become a hub for tourism and ecotourism, which is fascinating.
So how do you get to Telegraph Cove?
It's a long drive. There was no road up Vancouver Island until almost 1980. Before that, you could only get to these small communities by boat.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1979, there was a road that actually carried on north of Campbell River. If you keep driving north of Campbell River for about 2.5 hours, you get to Telegraph Cove. And it is literally the end of its little road. It's about a half hour south of Port McNeill, across the strait from Alert Bay.
So in a family bought now the town?
Actually, the town has always been privately owned, and it's still privately owned.
From your family?
My family owned it to start with, and then when my grandparents died and the sawmill was finished, then it was sold to a man who bought half of it, the historic part where all the old houses are. He's still living there. He and his wife have built up that business, have done an incredible job. The houses look better now than they ever did in the past. And there's another family that owned the what was the undeveloped side, and they've put in an RV park and a marina, and that you could also buy lots and build a house up there if you would like. So it's still privately owned land.
Will you go and live there?
To live there? No, I'm not capable enough. I look at these women, and this is 100 years ago, and what their life must have been like. In the winter, it's rainy. It's dark, it's cold, you get these cold winds that come in, and there's nothing. There's no store, there's no coffee shop. If you want to go anywhere now, you have to drive half an hour to go and get your groceries or your coffee or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's if the weather is not prohibitively bad. If you have a boat, you can get across the strait to Alert Bay, or you could actually go into Port McNeil or Port Hardy further north by boat. But it's long, cold, dark winters, and you have to be capable of power outages, dealing with fuel issues or any other weather-related issues, loneliness. No, it is not the sort of place where a city girl like me would last very long. I am all in admiration for the people that do live in places like that.
Well, this is awesome. I am so happy that you came and that you tell us this story. Your book is really excellent, and I hope everybody gets your book.
The Boom and Bust, The Resilient Women of Historic Telegraph Cove.
Yes.
Thank you, Daniela. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
I know, and I love that you have so many stories, and it's true. Everybody has a story, right?
And, that's nonfiction stories are the most amazing. We make up these wonderful stories. We read about them in fictional books. But when you talk to somebody and listen to what their life was like, sometimes you think, no one could make that up. That's incredible.
It's true. So you're very fortunate to have the stories of your family like this. I wish I could have done the same. So thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you very much. I really enjoy being here with you.